Hello and welcome on The Circle Day on Resonance 104.4 FM with me, Yadette Gerez, and I'm Rosabella Gerez-Hall. Today we have Leah Keith on the show. She's an American writer. Okay, Rosabella, you said your point. Who's an American writer, radical feminist, food activist, and... Rosa, can I do the intro, please? I sacked you once off the show. Don't make me sack you again. Leah Keith is an American writer, radical feminist, food activist, and radical environmentalist. She has written a book called The Vegetarian Myth, and that is what she's going to talk about on this show. Tell me about how you came to write The Vegetarian Myth.
Well, I was actually a vegan myself for 20 years. And my health failed permanently and catastrophically, so I really had to reevaluate what I was doing and why I was doing it. And I think for a lot of vegans, that is the path out. And when you're a vegan, it's not just what you eat, it really becomes who you are. It's a very intense identity. And a lot of us don't give that up unless we're under extreme pressure. For a lot of the sort of recovering vegans that I've met, that's the story, is that, you know, our health just degenerated further and further and further until we finally had to just stop. And it was a very hard day. It's not an easy moment in anybody's life, so I don't take any of this lightly. This was not an easy decision to make. That was one of the reasons that I wrote the book, was because I really didn't want the next generation of, you know, idealistic, environmentally inclined young people to end up with the same kind of damage that I ended up with. And there's a whole generation of us here now, people who are middle-aged, who are my age, who have already tried it. And we saw where it ended, and it was pretty disastrous for us. So I wanted to get that story out there because I think that, you know, the people who care the most about the planet are generally very attracted to veganism because of, you get this whole plan, you know, if you eat this way, you'll save animals and you'll save the planet. And it seems to make a lot of sense. And I don't want them to sort of get led down that path to the point where they can't look back before they get alternate information, because there is more information out there now, but it's hard to find. And if all your friends are doing this, it becomes a lot of social pressure as well, that, you know, when you're in environmental circles, it tends to be the default setting that you're a vegetarian or you're trying to be a vegan. A lot of that is because we live in these urban industrial environments. So we don't have access to the alternate information on a daily level. We don't see it. We don't know where our food comes from. We don't know what the cost of that food is to the planet. And so it's easy to accept, you know, the information that we're hearing from all around us about, you know, the benefits of being a vegetarian. So I understand how I got into it. I understand how other young people get into it. And I'm just trying to provide, you know, that alternate information before it's too late for the next generation as well.
People who are vegetarian or vegan usually stop eating meat for moral, political, or nutritional reasons. Can you talk about what you mean by this in your book?
You know, the first thing that I try to emphasize is that the values that underlie the vegetarian ethic are not the problem. So compassion and justice and sustainability and all the ways that we've learned to critique human hubris and human entitlement, those are really important. I mean, those are really the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need. So it's not the values that are the problem. The problem is really just one of information. And it's this really profound cultural ignorance about the nature of agriculture. And so that's what I was trying to write about in my book. So the three main reasons, like you said, that people become vegetarian, the first one is the moral reason I wanted my life to be possible without animals having to suffer or die. And I thought that that was possible. And that was because I didn't live where my food was grown. I'd never grown any food myself. I had no idea how much death was involved. So it was a very simple equation. When I looked at my plate, was there a dead animal on it or not? And if there wasn't a dead animal on it, then I thought, great, this is death-free, because I had no idea how much death went into all the plant foods. Having never grown them myself, I just didn't have a clue. So it's a very simple line to draw if you don't know better about how the natural world actually works. So that's the moral equation. And then politically, there's this idea that, you know, all the grain that's going to feed animals should go to feed humans instead. And on the surface, of course, that idea seems to make a lot of sense. The further I dug into it, the more I realized that it's completely backwards. That animals, especially ruminants like cows, were never intended to eat grain.
Mm.
And the only reason they're eating that grain is because grain has been made so cheap by fossil fuel. So there, especially in the United States, there's this huge glut of corn. Just vast quantities, mountains of corn have been produced since 1950. And it's so cheap that it suddenly made a bizarre kind of sense to feed it to animals. And the only reason they do that is because of capitalism. So the grain got really cheap. And when you feed corn to cows, what happens is they get really fat really fast. They get really sick really fast, too. They can only do that for, you know, 60 days before they start dropping dead. But in that time period, when they're in a feedlot, they will get really big in a really short amount of time, and it's cheap enough that they can do that. So this being capitalism, that was the model that took over. But this has nothing to do with the actual needs of the cow. It also produces a product that's really bad for human health. Nutritionally, it's very, very inadequate and, in fact, dangerous for humans to eat that kind of food because that's not the natural diet of a cow. But I didn't know that. So all I was told was, oh, you know, you hear these statistics all the time. It's 18 pounds of grain to make a pound of beef. Well, that's true if you're feeding them grain, but they're not actually meant to eat grain because it will kill them in the end. What cows are meant to eat is grass. That's what they evolved eating. That's what ruminants eat is grass. And if we were to let animals be animals again and get them out of those basically urban environments where they're stuck in those horrible feedlots and in, you know, the cement floors and the horrible crowded conditions, and they could eat what they were meant to eat, it's a completely different equation. Because then you've got ruminants on grass, and that is a self-sustaining system. You don't need any fossil fuel for that. You don't need any grain for that. That is a system that could go on forever. And so it's truly sustainable. And that's what never gets added into this kind of debate about feeding, you know, grain to cows and that should go to people. So that's one big thing, is that that's not actually the natural diet of a cow. The other problem is that, you know, in saying that, oh, well, instead we should give that grain to people, you know, people can't actually buy it. They can't afford it. And so there's a way bigger political problem. It's not that there's competition between cows and poor people in the third world. The problem is that when you actually take that cheap grain and you indeed give it to people in third world countries, they actually have a term for that, and it's called agricultural dumping. And it's actually a human rights violation, because what it means is that the local farmers are driven out of business. And this has been happening at an accelerating pace around the world because of things like NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. They've removed the trade barriers that were protecting local farms, and instead there's this huge glut of cheap grain from the United States, and they've driven millions of farmers out of business around the world. And what happens is they lose their land, their communities lose their ability to be self-sufficient, and it means that poor people are driven off their land, where at least they could be self-sufficient. They're driven off that land and into urban squalor. And that's what's been happening over the last 50 years. So in fact, this plea to feed all that cheap grain to starving people somewhere else, it's just imperialism. I mean, that's the basic model. You make it so that people can't support themselves, and then they're dependent on, you know, the imperialist countries, the rich nations of the world, so that they have to buy their food. And that means that they have to sell whatever they have for pennies. So either cheap labor making things like sneakers or, you know, computer motherboards, or their, quote, natural resources, which means they have to sell their trees or sell their oil or sell their minerals or sell their fish to rich people again. And then with the pennies they get in exchange, they can then buy cheap commodities from the United States. And it's bizarre to me that anybody on the left calls this justice. In any other situation, we would understand this is the basis of imperialism. It's the basis of genocide. When it comes to food, suddenly this is the model that we're after. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's like we haven't really thought this one through, because when Walmart does it, we understand it. But if the grain cartels do it, if Continental or Cargill or Monsanto does it, suddenly we're going to call it something that's just, and it clearly is not. You know, just as an example, 2 million farmers have been pushed off their land in Mexico, and that's why in the United States, you know, there's this huge pressure at the border with, quote, illegal immigration. Well, where else are they going to go? They've lost their land, and it's very specifically because of those large corporations that have done agricultural dumping. and made that way of life impossible now, where the farmers can't support themselves. So politically, this doesn't make any sense, and it's the one part of the vegetarian myth that's actually wrong. The rest of what I would call the vegetarian myth, I think people are at least trying to ask the right questions, but when you talk about the cheap food and the grain and the commodity agriculture, this just ends in hell for everybody. So we've got that one completely backwards. So I hope that people will take another look at what actually it means to send that cheap grain to poor people around the world. And it really is just destroying their ability to be self-sufficient. Okay, and then the third reason is nutritional. And a lot of people think that eating this kind of high-carb, low-fat diet will somehow improve their health status. And that's just completely false as well. It's not an adequate diet for the long-term maintenance and repair of the human body. And it's inadequate in a whole bunch of ways.
What would you say to people that have a psychological barrier about eating meat? Because that's quite an obstacle to overcome, really.
It's really hard. I would say it was one of the hardest days of my life. Definitely in the top five, especially after 20 years of not eating it. And I was desperate. And a lot of the people who write to me are right on the verge. You know, they've been vegan for a long time, and they've seen their health deteriorate, and they know that they're going to have to do this, but it's the hardest thing that they've ever done.
Yeah.
So I would tell people that you just have to go slowly, that you've built up these tremendous taboos, and it's not an easy thing to do, but there is an after. You know, the day comes when you've done it, and you feel tremendously better, and then you can start to reassemble a kind of, you know, sort of your new behavioral plan, you know, like how, and the ideology that goes with that. So you don't have to change your basic values. I'm not asking anybody ever to give up their compassion, you know, their longing for a just world. But we do have to build a new kind of framework around that, about what it really means to be sustainable, what it actually means to be eating agricultural foods. Because once you realize that agriculture is the single most destructive thing that people have done to the planet, it's a way bigger question than what's dead on my plate. You have to ask, well, what died to get that food on my plate? And if you're eating annual grains, I mean, the answer is really the whole world at this point. You know, we're in a state of complete biological collapse, and agriculture is the beginning of that collapse. That's the most, you know, it's the most terrible thing people have done to this living world. It's the main way that we've destroyed it. And so when you can take a step back historically and see that fact, then you realize that there's death in everything you're eating. And the only choices we get on this planet, you know, are we going to participate in that cycle of life, or are we going to destroy that cycle of life? And there's not a death-free option. And that was such a hard thing for me to come to terms with. So I would tell people, you know, if they're sort of facing this choice right now, that it is one of the hardest things you will ever do, that other people have gone before you, and we did live through it. And, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to have to reassemble a lot of your framework, your sense of identity, but your basic ethics can stay the same. You don't have to give up everything to do this, but it is not a fun day. And, you know, if you can have people around you to hold your hand while you do it, it does help.
Why is good fats so important for your brain, and why does cholesterol get the blame for heart disease, for example?
Well, your body needs cholesterol in every single cell. Cholesterol and saturated fat are what give your cells their structural stability. So around every cell is a membrane. That's what makes it a cell. And that membrane is mostly provided by saturated fat and cholesterol. And if you didn't have that, we would all be puddles. We would be like, you know, sort of a great big blob lying on the floor. I mean, literally, that's what gives our body that kind of structural stability. And that's especially true for things like your arteries, your blood vessels are under pressure, right? Your blood pressure. And they need to be really strong to be able to take that, you know, for 80 or 90 years. Your brain is over 60% fat and indeed 25% cholesterol. That's what your brain is made out of. It's basically a big chunk of fat. And the reason is actually that we are electrical impulses inside a watery environment. That's what animals are. And the only way that those electrical impulses are going to fire, the only way that our nerves are actually going to work as nerves, is they have to be insulated from the liquid environment inside us. And what does that insulation job is fat. You may have heard of the myelin sheath that coats every nerve. Well, a great deal of that is fat. And this is especially true in the brain because, you know, that's the biggest neurological organ that we've got, right, is your brain. So there's tons of fat in there keeping all the nerves firing. It's keeping them separated from each other so that they can actually work. Now, cholesterol is such an important substance that every single cell in your body can actually make it. Though the liver's, one of the liver's main jobs is to regulate and produce cholesterol. If you don't have enough, your liver will make more of it. But every single cell in your body needs it, and every cell can try to make it if you don't have enough. And that's especially true in your brain. So if you don't have enough cholesterol and enough saturated fat in your diet, your neurological impulses can't actually fire. And so that means that no matter how many neurotransmitters you've got, they can't actually work unless they've got some fat to help them. So that's your brain. And then you can talk about other parts of your body and other organs and organ systems. Your digestive system also needs a whole bunch of cholesterol. If you think about your intestines, they've got a tough job to do because, you know, you're eating, and that means that you're introducing all kinds of foreign substances that are coming into your mouth and then through your body. And so your intestines have to keep out all those foreign bodies, you know, things like bacteria and viruses and dirt and microbes and parasites and God knows what all is coming through there all the time. And one way that your intestines work to keep those things from attaching or from getting in is that every 48 hours you have an entirely new lining in the surface of your guts. So it's shedding all the time. So anything that grips on can't get a hold, because it's shedding. But that means that your intestines, your guts need lots and lots of cholesterol so that they can build new cells every 48 hours. So especially if you have any kinds of gut problems, it's really important to get tons of cholesterol and saturated fat to keep that, you know, that cycle going at a healthy clip. And then your heart actually prefers saturated fat as fuel because it provides a very steady source of fuel. Your brain as well prefers saturated fat for fuel for the same reason. It's a very steady source of fuel. If you're getting your basic fuel from a carbohydrate, it's just sugar. So there's these intense, you know, swings, blood sugar swings throughout the day. And you can only function, the human body can only function at if it's too high or too low, you actually can get very sick very quickly. It's a biological emergency, essentially. And diabetics certainly know this. If it drops too low, you can fall into a coma. If it goes too high, you can pass out. And ultimately, you can die from either end of that being too low or too high. So it's a very small range of, you know, what your brain can take in terms of sugar. So sugar is a very unstable source of fuel. And fat is not. Fat is very stable. So that's why it's preferred. And we could go through a bunch of other different systems, but your endocrine system, so all of your hormones, they are all built from cholesterol. And so you have to eat saturated fat in order to have any hormones. If you had no saturated fat in your diet at all, or no fat at all, you would have no hormones at all. So that includes all your sex hormones. We would all be infertile if we weren't getting some fat. And there's actually, this is a little bit grim, but there's a form of torture in some countries where they actually deny prisoners food with any fat in it. So their diets are completely stripped of fat.
Wow.
They say that the emotional, the agony of that kind of diet within weeks will break just about anybody, because it's supposed to be just the most agonizing mental state that you can imagine, not to have any fat at all in the diet. So you really need fat. There's just no way around it. A couple other things you might need it for. Your body can't absorb minerals. No matter how many minerals you're eating in your diet, if there's no saturated fat going down with it, you're just simply not going to absorb those minerals. So this is why we have seen this huge upswing in osteoporosis in the rich countries, is because everyone's, especially women, have been convinced to eat these low-fat diets, and it means that their mineral status has gone down and down, and over time, of course, their bones just get brittle from it, and that's why, that's a disease of the first world, and that's one of the reasons why is these low-fat diets that everybody's been convinced to eat. So how did this happen, right? I mean, most of our history on the planet, that was the food that everybody loved and everybody preferred. And you can look through all kinds of anthropological literature and first-hand accounts of indigenous people, and you read over and over that fat is what they love. They would even have fat orgies where, you know, for 4 days people would eat nothing but fat after they had a good hunt. And a lot of animals were hunted preferentially, or still hunted preferentially, because of the fat. Like, for instance, there's male elk that'll have, this huge slab of fat on their backs in the fall. And so that's when they'll be hunted in particular, is because everybody knows that's when you're going to get the good stuff. So how did this happen, that, you know, what used to be the food that everybody enjoyed and everybody knew was good for human health, it got vilified? And it's a really important political question. The best book on this, if people really want a lot of information, if you want more detail, the best book is, it's by Gary Taubes, and it's called Good Calories, Bad Calories. And he's got a whole chapter on this. But just to make it really quick, you know, you gotta follow the money on everything.
Yeah.
And the big corporations right now, there's about 6 corporations that control the world food supply. Literally 6 corporations. And they mostly control it through controlling the grain, the production and the sale of grain around the world. So they make the most money if we buy those products, because they're incredibly cheap to produce, especially because they're based on fossil fuel. And that's something we need to understand here, is that the amount of grain being produced right now is only possible because human beings figured out how to turn cheap oil and gas into fertilizer. So it's very, very nitrogen-dense fertilizer, and they combine that with genetic engineering and specialty breeding, and that was what created the Green Revolution. So they had this whole new palette of plants that grew really short and produced these gigantic seed heads, and that's only possible by providing them with this huge amount of nitrogen. And the nitrogen comes from oil and gas, okay? So all this grain that everybody's always talking about should go to poor people, set aside the fact that it crashes their local economies, it's only possible because of oil and gas. And we are now past peak, right? I think everybody should be, you know, get the picture here. Peak oil has happened probably a year or two ago. So we're on the downslope of that curve. So that grain production is going to drop off eventually. Okay, this was not a sustainable way to be creating food for human beings. Not really sure why people got into it, but it's going to be a great big disaster if we don't sort of take control of the situation soon. But anyway, all that aside, it's really cheap to produce that grain right now because of fossil fuel. And when they take those products, those grains, and they turn them into what they call value-added products, so things like cereal or bread or corn chips or potato chips, that's where they make the most profit, because the grain, they can get it for pennies on the pound, and then, you know, they do a couple things to it to make it sort of more yummy for humans, and then they can sell it for a lot more. And that's what's happened in the United States. So that's the reason why. I mean, that's the financial reason why. That's the economic sort of impetus for getting everybody to eat that low-fat, high-carb diet. It's because when we eat more and more of those grain products, they make more money. They don't make anywhere near as much money on things like butter or eggs. And when those things are produced properly, they really can only be produced in a good way by small farms, which, of course, corporate America, you know, they're doing their best to drive out the last small farms in the United States. So that's really, you know, the sort of David versus Goliath situation that we're in. And I don't know what it's like in the United Kingdom, but in the United States, there's a gigantic government agency called the USDA, and that's the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And their job is to sell commodity agricultural products. Their job is not to produce health in the American population. Their job is to sell the products that corporate agriculture produces. And hence, they came up with what's called the food pyramid. I don't know if you guys have that in your country, but this has been, you know, everywhere. This has been absolutely hegemonic for the last 30 years. And it's this pyramid. And at the bottom, it tells you that you need to eat, you know, this vast quantity of grain every single day. So pasta and bread and whatever else. And the reason they do this is because their job is to sell those foods. And that's exactly, it's no more complicated than that. So they've managed to convince everybody that this is the healthy way to eat. Now what's happened here is that it's been a disaster. I mean, public health has just declined and declined and declined. We've seen an upswing especially in diseases like diabetes. I mean, they used to call it type 2 diabetes, you know, it used to be called adult onset diabetes mm-hmm. because it took 40 or 50 years for people to run through their insulin receptors such that they then had to take insulin, you know, outside insulin that they had to inject or swallow. That used to take 40 or 50 years to get to that state. Well, now they're seeing it in 10-year-olds. And it's because people used to eat eggs and bacon for breakfast, and now they're eating skim milk and some kind of toasted flake cereal, or even worse, you know, a Pop-Tart or a Sticky Bomb, and it's nothing but a pile of sugar. Mm. So by the time they're 10 or 12 or 15, these kids, it's the same thing. They've blown through their insulin receptors, and now they're insulin dependent. And that was just never seen, you know, until this generation. And then you can add all the other problems that kids are having, with things like attention deficit disorder and the behavioral problems, depression in children like has never been seen. It all goes back to, a lot of it anyway, goes back to this incredibly insufficient diet for the human brain and for the development of, you know, that human biological template. You're just not going to meet those needs eating nothing but essentially sugar all day long. But that's the reason why, is because it's the most profit that corporations can make is when we eat those foods.
So you think anyone that decides to cut meat and dairy, well, you know, you've done the research, anyone that decides to cut meat and dairy out of their diet, they're bound to fall ill eventually, because this is something that you don't really hear. You don't hear this side of the argument at all, especially within the movement, because being vegan is, such a part of, I guess, the movement, and it shows that it shows how moral you are, I guess, about a lot, many other things as well. That's how it's seen.
You know, let me just run through a few problems you'll probably have if you stick to this long term. The first is that you're going to end up with blood sugar problems. You're going to get really hypoglycemic, and that's because the human body was never meant to absorb that amount of sugar every day. If you eat the amount of carbohydrate that the USDA is telling us to eat, it ends up that you're eating almost 2 cups of sugar a day. And there's no possible way.
That's insane.
That in our ancestral history, we were running into that much sugar. Mm. You know, during the warm, you know, the end of the warm season when there might have been some fruit, you might have had a couple of tablespoons a day. But that amount of sugar, it will kill you.
Yeah.
So, you know, your insulin receptors are going to get more and more and more worn down. So you're going to have to eat more frequently. You're going to get more lightheaded and dizzy and more cranky. Mm-hmm. And then weepy and all those, you know, emotional problems that go along with the low blood sugar thing. I mean, by the time I was then being a vegan, I had to eat every half an hour or I was just, you know, a mess. And that's not unusual. That's the reason why, is because it just, your insulin receptors just can't take it after, you know, that much sugar. That's one problem. Another problem is the depression, the anxiety, those kinds of emotional problems that I've seen over and over, you know, in my circle of friends, that I experienced myself. And one of the reasons is because of the lack of saturated fat. And the other reason is because of the lack of good quality protein, in particular the amino acid tryptophan. And, you know, you may know of tryptophan because it's the precursor for serotonin. And, you know, without enough serotonin, you're going to get depressed. Your body cannot make tryptophan, you can only eat it. And from tryptophan, your body will then manufacture serotonin. So right now in the United States, we've had this epidemic of depression. And again, it really traces back to, you know, the drop in the eating of saturated fat and this rise in the eating of, the consuming of carbohydrate. And the protein is not adequate, and without that saturated fat, it doesn't even matter. All the tryptophan in the world, you can't make serotonin work without saturated fat. And then another problem is that with all the factory farms, all those animals are being, you know, stuffed with grain. Well, the problem is that things like corn are very low in tryptophan. So even if you are eating meat and dairy and eggs, if they come from factory farms, because the animals' diets are inadequate, the products that come from them are inadequate. So you can still have not enough tryptophan even if you're eating meat, because you're eating the wrong meat. You're eating meat that's, you know, came from a tortured animal that was incorrectly fed. So, I mean, this is definitely one of the reasons that we've seen this huge upswing in depression in the United States. It's this nutritional basis to it. So that's a couple of things. For women, you may find that you see a tremendous drop-off in your hormone levels, and a lot of vegan women stop menstruating, and we all pretended this was normal, but it's not normal. You're supposed to get your period every month. And this was, and the soy especially can have a tremendously deleterious effect on both men and women in terms of hormones. These are drugs. These are not foods. They're endocrine disruptors, essentially, with the phytoestrogens. And I know two women who ended up with endometriosis from eating soy products. One of them had to have a hysterectomy in the end. It definitely did a number on my reproductive organs, eating all that soy. And it was very dramatic for me when I stopped eating soy. My reproductive organs got better within 2 weeks. I couldn't believe how much better I was. But sometimes it's too late. If you do it for too long, the damage can be very permanent. So the depression, the anxiety, you may have reproductive issues. You may also end up with things like joint problems, which, you know, ultimately would be arthritis. And that's one of the things that happened to me. And again, it's because, you know, that saturated fat, you're not going to be absorbing the correct amount of minerals that you need. Your body can't utilize them without the fat. And, you know, the other problem is that, you know, the foods that you're eating as a vegan especially simply don't have the amount of minerals that the human body requires. And then finally, you have the fat-soluble vitamins, which are only available in animal products. So vitamin A, vitamin D, and some forms of vitamin K are very hard to extract from plant foods. You just can't get these without eating some animal fat. So, you know, if you are going to try to keep being a vegan, please, please, please look into supplementing these, because you will eventually, you know, end up with deficiencies. And these are not things to fool around with. And, of course, the other thing is the B12. And just don't play around with that. Please just take the B12 until you decide whether I'm full of shit or whether I'm worth listening to. You got to take the B12. I have heard from any number of neurologists now from all over the world who have written to me and said, thank God you wrote this book. I see these people every week. They have done permanent damage to their eyesight and their hearing because they refuse to take the B12 and they won't listen to me. And now I hand them your book. And it's really an honor to think that I may have helped somebody, you know, who's in that state. But, you know, the take-home point here is that if you're at all considering continuing with a vegan diet, please look into the fact that, try to accept that it may not be nutritionally adequate. Because if you wait until there's damage, it really may be too late. So those are some of the main problems that people can get, you know, being vegan, and some of the reasons for it. So I just hope people will consider this, you know, as they move forward in their lives.
Derek Jensen and yourself both talk about civilization as damning and as if it's the worst thing that the Earth has had happen to her. Can you explain how our presence as humans since agriculture and civilization as we know it means hierarchy, patriarchy, exploitation and capitalism?
So the basis of civilization is this activity called agriculture. And that means that everybody has to understand what agriculture is. In very brute terms, you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant that land to human use. So two problems right away. One is, this is biotic cleansing, because all the plants and animals and microbes that need to live on that land have nowhere to go. You've cleaned them off. And that's another way to say mass extinction. So right now, 99% of the prairies have been destroyed around the world. 99% of the grasslands are gone. Okay, they've been eradicated. And 98% of the old-growth forests are gone. And the main reason is this activity called agriculture. Anywhere that people can grow these grain crops, they are now growing them. So all that land has been taken over. And that means that all those animals and all those plants, all those biomes have been destroyed so that we can grow wheat and corn and soy and whatever. So that's one problem. Okay, another problem is that this is an inherently destructive activity. Besides the fact that, you know, you've eradicated all those other species, what you're also destroying is the topsoil. The moment that you clear that soil, you're destroying it. That soil needs the protective cover of those perennial plants, and it also needs the deep root structure of those plants. That is what holds soil in place. That is what makes the habitat. Soil is not just dead dirt. It's actually animate. You know, one tablespoon of soil contains over a million different living creatures. One tablespoon of soil. And those are the creatures that are doing the basic work of life. We can't see them with our eyes, but our lives are impossible without them. They are the ones who recycle, keep the nutrient cycles moving so that nutrients are always available for plants and animals. And they also, you know, do incredible things with the water cycle, and they make oxygen, and they do all this other stuff. But this is their planet. They are the ones who made it livable. They are the ones who create habitat for the rest of us, and they are the ones who keep it at this homeostasis where our lives are then possible. And we're destroying all of them when we do agriculture. We're ripping off the cover, we're taking the roots out, and then we just turn it into desert. Mm. And the planet is now out of topsoil. And this is a really scary thought. We've skinned the planet alive, essentially. So since the year 1950, you know, the planet has been, you know, all those agricultural regions have essentially been, you know, destroyed. And so instead of drawing down the soil, we've substituted fossil fuel for that. But that's not a plan with the future. So the problem with agriculture is that it's this massive drawdown. It's a massive drawdown of species, it's a massive drawdown of ecosystems, and ultimately it's a drawdown of the ecosystem called soil. Because without soil, we can't live. Our entire lives are dependent on 6 inches of soil and the fact that it rains. So we're destroying the matrix of life itself. So here's the problem. So you've got a group of people who start doing agriculture. Okay, they clear off the trees, they destroy the grasslands, they go ahead and they plant their wheat or whatever it is they're going to plant. And then year by year, there's less soil, there's less fertility in the soil. And, you know, you can see the archaeological record. Their health gets worse and worse. They shrink, they lose their teeth, their bones are riddled with diseases. And eventually, it draws down to nothing. That's what drawdown is, right? It's a downward line. You hit zero, and they've got to go out and get more land because they've destroyed their own. In the process, of course, they've also destroyed their trees and destroyed their water and destroyed their animals and everything's, you know, they're using it all up. So now they have to go out and get more. And this is where imperialism comes from. They need to take over the land that belongs to their neighbors. So this is the pattern that's called civilization. You've got people living in these densities where the only way they can feed themselves is by taking over the land, turning it over just to humans. So they're only growing food for humans. And then as the soil draws down and as they destroy the water, then they have to go out and take their neighbors away from them. And so that's the pattern. You've got this bloated power center at the middle of the empire, and then you've got conquered colonies all around it. And eventually the power center strips the surrounding colonies as well, and then the entire thing collapses. And we've seen this over and over and over for 10,000 years. And a good example would be something like ancient Rome. Mm. You know, the forests of northern Africa were completely deforested. They were completely destroyed. The area was just turned into that sort of semi-arid desert landscape that you think of now. That's not a natural phenomenon. That is a human-made phenomenon. And those trees fell to build the navy for Rome, and they fell so that that land could be turned into agriculture. Mm. And it used to be that civilizations at least had... there were some natural limits to how big they could get. And those limits were really set by the length of distance that pack animals could travel, because the food had to get from the colonies into the center, the power center, into the big city. And then also the military orders had to get from the military center out to the colonies, to where, you know, people were being... where they're under this kind of imperialist rule. So there was, you know, this problem with the orders flowing back and forth, and then there was the problem of getting the food supplies back and forth. So that meant that the distance, you know, eventually those lines would snap. So the distance was actually, you know, the sort of human-scale civilizations. And what saved Northern Europe from Rome, from, you know, the imperial grasp of Rome, was actually the Alps. The mountains were something too tall. So Rome conquered around the Mediterranean because they could get there on boats, but they couldn't get across those mountains. So the rest of Europe was pretty well saved from that sort of rapacious grip of the Roman Empire. Otherwise, it would have fallen as well. But they couldn't really do it because of the mountains. Anyway, that's the pattern that you see over and over, and it's dependent on imperialism and genocide. And this is all because it's based on drawdown. Because when you have people living in those concentrations, it means that they've used up their own supplies. A good example would be the island of Manhattan. And there's like 3 million people who live on that island. Mm. It's crazy. There's no way that island could support 3 million people. Of course, the food and the water and the energy are going to have to come from somewhere else. And other people do not willingly give up their food and their water and their trees and their soil. And so this is why you have a class of people called soldiers. And their job is to go out and get those things. And it means conquering people, and it means, you know, the genocide, the imperialism. So that is the history of every civilization that has ever arisen. Civilizations generally last as long as their topsoil, so anywhere from 800 to maybe 1500 years, somewhere in there, and then they collapse. So, you know, we're going to see the end of this one. There's no way that anything based on drawdown can go on forever. And, you know, I guess the real question is, what are we going to do about it now? This is not, you know, a way of life that's based on justice. It's not a way of life that could ever be sustainable. It feels like, you know, it's normal and natural because we're used to it. I mean, we've been living in these agricultural societies now for, you know, somewhere around 10,000 years. Certainly, you know, those of us who live in industrial nations, I mean, it's definitely all we've known for a long time now. But it's, you know, it's not a plan with a future. And, you know, the underpinnings of it are these, you know, tremendously unjust systems. And it, you know, it creates these hierarchies of power and injustice just to keep the whole thing going. So it's a, you know, it's a grim sort of history, but it's, I guess it's there to face this so that we know what we're up against.
In your book, The Vegetarian Myth, you talk about how culture has managed to demonize traditional and natural food that is essential in maintaining a healthy diet. You talk about corporate interest as the main culprit. For me, for example, you talked about cholesterol, and I was discussing this with my friend. Actually, we always argue about many other different things, but with cholesterol, she said to me, well, why is cholesterol bad if everybody, all the doctors and everything, and in the media and on telly, everyone says that cholesterol is bad for you, so why is it good? But you explained that very well before, but if you could just maybe talk about corporate interest as a problem.
That's a really good question. So we already talked about the corporate food producers and the grain cartels and how that's how they make the most money.
Yeah.
The other piece of this, though, is the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm.
And remember, this is an absolute gigantic industry.
Mm.
And their number one selling drug now, I think for the last 10 years, is Lipitor. And that is, you know, a drug that's supposed to lower cholesterol. And this is the number one selling drug around the world. There are tremendous financial interests in getting us all to believe that cholesterol will kill us, because then we will all take this drug.
Mm.
And, you know, just as a side note, those statin drugs that are supposed to lower cholesterol are tremendously dangerous drugs. I mean, people get things like permanent nerve damage. They get global amnesia, where they don't even know what their names are anymore.
Mm.
Neuropathy, where they can't feel their hands and their feet, and they, you know, can't move their arms or their legs anymore. I've seen this in my own family. They're really, really scary drugs, and people should look into them. If anybody you know is on these drugs, please do the research about, you know, the alternative view on what these drugs actually do to people. And the best book is a book called Lipitor, Thief of Memory, and it's by a cardiologist named Duane Graveline. And he used to believe in the whole lipid hypothesis and in trying to lower people's cholesterol. And then he himself was put on a statin drug, and it nearly killed him. So he went back and he did a lot of research about what is actually going on with these drugs and wrote this book, which is an incredible expose of how dangerous these drugs are. So people need to get that one too, that you know, follow the money, that this is there's a huge amount of money to be made by demonizing something as harmless as cholesterol. So yeah, that's the other part is definitely the pharmaceutical industry and the influence that they have over things like the schools that teach nutrition. The sugar industry is another one. They have a huge influence over the nutrition schools. And if you look in some of the professional journals for nutritionists, there would be like full page ads for sugar. It's insane. But that's where they're getting all their money from.
Do you think you can change the world by consumer means?
And I think that's one of the ways that we've really been led astray. You know, capitalism has done a really good job on all of us trying to separate us and turn us into individual consumers so that we'll buy stuff. So at this point, it's this really scary thing when people who are otherwise politically aware have reduced their own capacity as activists to simply buying things. Like, that's really scary to me. And that is like the main strategy that the environmental movement, at least the mainstream environmental movement, is handing us. You know, it's all our individual problem, and we can all solve it as individuals. So we never have to name capitalism. We never have to name industrialization. We never have to name civilization itself. All we have to do is, oh, buy this instead of that. And I think in any other instance, most people who are sort of leftist leaning would get that that's completely ridiculous. But we've got this whole generation of people now who have sort of swallowed this idea that, you know, if we simply buy a different kind of light bulb or buy a cloth bag instead of a plastic bag, that we're somehow going to stop, you know, the sociopathic destruction of our planet. I mean, we are really on the verge of complete biotic collapse. You know, I mean, the rate of destruction is only accelerating. There's not a single biological indicator that's going in the right direction. I mean, our planet really could be dead in 50 years. And we think that somehow, you know, buying, you know, a green refrigerator or something is going to make, this is going to take an incredible amount of political resistance to take down the system that we live under. And yet they've managed to convince the people who care the most that if they simply buy a different product, that that is political activism. I mean, a good example of this would be like Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth. You get to the end of that movie, and there is nothing in that list except individual consumer choices. In the meantime, you've got these very clear systems of power that are literally gutting the planet alive, and they're turning, you know, living communities into dead commodities and then into private wealth. That's what capitalism does. We're not going to save this planet as long as capitalism stands, right? But we think we're going to buy our way out of this problem. So he makes this whole movie and never once names capitalism. And, you know, we should be pretty mad at that movie for that reason. But everybody just accepts, oh, yeah, if I just, you know, ride my bike and make my compost pile and then, you know, use a cloth bag, it'll all be fine. It's not going to be fine. They're not going to give up without a struggle. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a separate question whether that struggle could be nonviolent or not. I mean, that comes way down the pike. But right now, we have to at least say out loud, yes, this is a power system. There are people in charge. They're being rewarded for sociopathic behavior. And they control the planet. They control the wealth on the planet. So we're going to have to stop them, and that is going to mean serious political organizing. There are no personal solutions to political problems, right? They take political movements to solve. Yeah. And for some reason, it's like this whole generation of us, we've erased that part of the equation from all of our thinking and all of our strategizing, and we got to get back on track here because we're running out of time.
What would you say to those skeptics who deny global warming as having anything to do with human beings?
The global warming deniers, they're kind of scary people. I don't know how bad it is in the United Kingdom, but here in the United States, it gets worse and worse and worse every year. You know, even 10 years ago, about 50% of the population thought that this was a serious problem. And now, it's like every year it drops. Mm. I mean, I live in a scary place. I will freely admit that this is a scary country. And it's getting more and more right-wing every day. Mm. You know, part of the problem is that they don't want to name capitalism. So capitalism is essentially the religion of the United States. I mean, you can put a Christian veneer on it, but really the guiding religion, and it's a monotheistic religion, is capitalism. And the idea that capitalism is, in fact, destroying the life support system of the planet, they can't comprehend that because it means questioning God. So they'll do anything to find an alternate explanation, no matter how bizarre it is. And, you know, I'll say things like, look, over 99.9% of all the scientists on the planet have come together internationally. They all agree this is happening. Mm. But, you know, people here don't want to hear it. So, you know, you're dealing with a fundamentalist when you talk to people who are global warming deniers. Mm. And I'm not sure that it's worth anybody's time. I think our efforts may be better spent just building the kind of political resistance that we need and trying to be effective to actually stop the burning of oil and coal and gas. I think that those people are just going to have to come along. Mm. And they're most of them aren't going to see it until it's too late. You know, I mean, right now we already have, you know, these island nations that are starting to be, you know, flooded. All the hurricanes and the tornadoes and the, you know, the floods that are happening already, the tsunamis, you know, the polar ice caps are melting. And the really scary thing for me is what's happening to all the animals, how the birds are migrating and their migrations are all a mess because they're getting the wrong signals and then they get too soon to the new spot and there's no food for them yet. I mean, a forest can only move a mile a year, and the birds need it to go faster, and it can't go any faster. And this is what scares me, is the habitat loss, the crash in animal populations that we're going to see over the next 50 years it's just horrifying. I mean, the scientists right now are debating whether it's a quarter, a third, or fully half of all mammals are going to be extinct by the year 2050. I'm still going to be alive in 2050. I'm going to be alive to see this. And the amount of suffering is just horrifying to me. So to me, I'm not sure that it's worth trying to get through the fundamentalist, you know, brain to try to get them to see reality. I think that our efforts may be better spent just trying to build the serious political resistance movement that our planet is really crying for right now.
What do you say to people that believe in reform rather than to end civilization when it comes to sorting out global warming and destruction?
You know, I think that we need a whole continuum of action, because from the bottom up, this culture is going to have to change. So from the really basic understanding that civilization and this activity called agriculture, that eventually that's going to have to stop. Not everybody's going to get that, and that's fine. They don't have to understand that. Right now, we've got some really primary emergencies going on, and, you know, one of the biggest ones is fossil fuel and, you know, what's happening to the climate. And the others, I guess, would be, you know, the destruction of the oceans, and then this the mass extinction, habitat loss, in terms of, you know, the old-growth forests and the remaining grasslands and all the things that have to be protected, the wetlands. So all of those together, I mean, are really creating this perfect storm of biological collapse around the world. And, you know, the most horrifying example that I've heard of in the last year is the fact that there are parts of China now where there are no longer any flowering plants. Mm-hmm. And you have to understand that is 500 million years of evolution. There are no more flowering plants. And that's because all the pollinators have been wiped out. So there are no more, you know, social insects. There are no more bees. There's nothing to pollinate those flowering plants. And so they're gone. They've just all disappeared. And that's what I mean when I say complete biotic collapse. It's like just huge chunks of the evolutionary tree are being chainsawed right off before our eyes. Anyway, so there's you know, when you're talking any kind of social change movement that's serious, you need a whole continuum of action to people to take. Because a lot of people aren't going to do the most radical thing. You know, they either don't have the personality for it, or they can't take risks for really legitimate reasons. I mean, if I had children, there's no way I could have written the books that I've written. I would not have taken those risks if I had children to raise. Or, you know, you may have old parents you have to take care of. I mean, there's lots of reasons that people can't get into trouble. And they're totally legitimate. And I never, ever want anybody to feel guilty for deciding what level of risk they can take. That is a decision everybody has to make for themselves. And that always needs to be respected. So there has to be something that everybody can do. So if you can't take a lot of risks in terms of doing things, you know, proposing radical solutions or engaging in more radical action, it's fine. There's a whole level of stuff that needs to happen in terms of cultural change. So, you know, we need people to be doing things like making direct democracy possible, fighting corporate personhood, you know, things that are in a totally legal, above ground, mainstream kinds of political change. And those things always need to happen in social movements. And they're legitimate activities and they're honorable activities, and people need to do them. And then we need another level of cultural change, which is like changing the basic story of the culture we tell. And this is the place for the storytellers and the musicians and the artists and the theater people, and all that needs to happen too, so that we can have a culture that's based on things like, you know, sustainability and compassion and care and connection and those really basic human values that make life worth living in human communities. All of that has also been destroyed by, you know, the basic needs of civilization, you know, those hierarchical, militarized, genocidal societies that we are now stuck with. We need to rehumanize ourselves, and we need to reanimalize ourselves and remember that, you know, we're part of a living planet, and that we all need each other, not just as humans, but as animals that need habitat. You know, the bacteria in the soil, that should be like, that's our brothers and our sisters, you know, those are, and our parents. I mean, they made this planet a habitat for us. So we need to have that respect again for the soil and for the trees and for the animals and all that kind of, you know, that ancient pagan worldview. We've got to bring all that back. So I guess what I'm saying is that there has to be a level of action that's appropriate for everybody who wants to join. So I don't ever want to make this distinction between, you know, who's a real revolutionary and who's just a reformist, because I think that all of that activity has to happen. We need the reformists to be pushing for direct democracy, for new culture, for new economic models, to be creating the food networks, to be creating the kind of healthcare that we need that's accessible to everyone and that's not technological medicine. All of that needs to happen. At the same time, we do need the front line after this to be doing those direct confrontations with power and to be taking down those power structures. But, you know, I don't think either is successful without the other. And in all the revolutionary movements that I've studied, both had to be going on at once for either to get anywhere. So we're like two wings of a bird, you know, and in order for our bird to fly, we need both wings working. So I just have a real hard time. I think it's very divisive to say, you know, to take this really hard-line radical stance and say, oh, those people are just reformists. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily just reformists. They may be doing something very radical as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's not everybody can be the frontline activist, and that's fine. And so we need to really respect wherever anybody is on that continuum. It's respectful work, and we need to treat each other with that kind of respect across the line.
There are alternatives to how we buy and eat meat. Can you share with us what you do, for example?
The most important thing to ask is, does my food create topsoil, or does it destroy topsoil? And that's because soil is the basis of life. And the second reason that's important is because right now, you know, the carbon just keeps climbing, right? And we're over 400 parts per million right now. And at a certain point, you know, the planet's just going to snap, and it won't be able to support life anymore. It'll be too hot. The thing that gives me hope is that if we were able to restore even 75% of the world's trashed out grasslands, and let's be clear, they've been destroyed for agriculture. If we were able to restore those grasslands, it would take less than 15 years, and we could sequester all the carbon that's been released since the beginning of the industrial age. And that is an incredible fact. Carbon would actually drop to 330 parts per million, and that is nicely below that 350 cutoff line. And that would take about 15 years. That's not a long time period. So you can participate in food that actually does that. It has to be based in pasture. So it has to be farmers that are growing grass above all else. Whatever else they're producing, it comes from the grass. And the health of the grass means the health of the land. What grass does better than any other living creature is it builds topsoil. And that basic building block of that soil is carbon. So it sucks carbon out of the air, and it sequesters it into soil, into that biomass of soil. So every time you buy an egg that is from a pasture-raised chicken or a pound of hamburger that came from a grass-fed cow, you are, in fact, sequestering carbon in the most efficient way that our planet knows how to do that. You're also probably supporting a local farmer, which means that money is being circulated throughout your local economy, and we all know how important that is to keep the money out of the hands of the 1% and keep it with the people who are doing the good work and who are your neighbors. But the most important thing is that you are sequestering carbon. So that's the thing you want to look for, is pasture-raised, grass-fed. And usually these are farms you can go visit, and that's a really good thing because we need way more transparency in the way that our food is made. If you can go to that farm and see it yourself, and it's a really moving experience because you can meet the people who are making your food. You can meet the animals that will be your food. You can meet the land itself. You can meet the grass. You can meet the soil and be thankful for the food that you're going to get. And you can also know that one day you'll be part of it. You know, we're all going to die and we will be recirculated. You're only borrowing this body, right? Every last molecule is going to be broken down and eaten by somebody else when your time comes. So it's very moving to me to be part of that. And when I had my own small farm, it was an amazing thing to participate in it. These are the words for the millennium, you know, it's grass-fed. And the more we can support those farmers, the more of those farmers they will be. The poor people who are stuck with the grain, growing the grain, I mean, they're basically serfs to those grain cartels. No matter how hard they work, they can never make a living. That's because those six grain cartels have a monopoly, right? And every year they're able to drive the cost. The price that they pay for grain is less than what it costs to produce it. So no matter how hard those poor farmers work, they can never keep their heads above water. Every year they're in more debt. That's true in the United States. It's true in India. The number one cause of death in farm country is suicide. Okay, it's true in our country, it's true in poor countries, and it's for that same reason. It's because of those grain cartels and the monopoly that they have. So here in the United States, the federal government kicks in money every year just to keep those farmers in business. But it all ends up in the pockets of Cargill and Continental and Monsanto. So again, we're going to have to take on that corporate power structure. Now contrast that with the farmers who are growing appropriate food on land where soil is being built, you know, where the basis of it is pasture, most grass-based farms can actually make a profit the first year. So these are people who can do honorable work. They're restoring the land. They're providing really good habitat for all kinds of animals. They're restoring waterways. They're building soil, sequestering carbon. There's no fossil fuel involved at all in this kind of food production because it's, you know, it's based on nature's template. And at the end of the day, they can actually make a living doing it. That is amazing to me. So the more that we can support that kind of farming, the more likely it is that more farmers will switch. And I have to say it's been one of the most moving things for me is as I traveled around doing talks about my book, to meet the farmers who read my book and then mm-hmm. changed the way they farmed. And to see some of that land and to see how it's come back to life. And they're like, you know, there's birds here that haven't been seen for 100 years because they restored the habitat. And they're able to make a living finally. And it's an incredible thing to be part of this movement. So I would really encourage people to look into this. If you've never heard of it, it's a good place to start as you, you know, maybe review some of what you thought you knew about the politics of food and look into grass-based farming and look into the farmers in your region, in your area, and see what kind of farming they're doing and see what ways you can get involved to support them. Because there are people doing the right thing, and it's really the only chance that our planet has is to restore those grasslands. So I just think it's the most important concept right now. If we're going to save, you know, what's left of this planet.
What's the last final message before we have to come to an end? Because it is phenomenal what we're all facing. And, you're coming across as quite rational, because you are rational, even though, like, you get quite a lot of flack. I've looked online and I've seen, like, you know, the things that... people have said that view your opinions as quite controversial, but I personally don't, and it's helped me actually. But any final kind of, and take as long as you like, but any final message, anything that you feel like you've missed out, or you know, go for it.
Yeah, this is the last moment we have to fight for our planet, and I think if anybody is alive 100 years from now, they're going to wonder what was wrong with us, that we didn't fight like hell when our planet was going down. And we've got to let our love for whatever it is we love, our children, our pets, our trees, you know, the spider outside your window, whatever small creature it is that you have affection for, it is under assault. And we've got to remember to fight. You know, there's like mother bears, mother mice, mother dogs. I can't think of a mother that doesn't fight for her children, and we have to remember to fight. You know, that the knowledge that we can fight has been taken from us, and this is going to be the biggest battle that's ever been waged, because we are up against absolute sociopaths, and they're not going to stop till every last living thing mm-hmm. is dead. They've made that quite clear. The tar sands. If there was any doubt, look at the tar sands. They're going to get every last drop and burn it. You know, and so some of us, I think, have come to that realization. As hard as it was, that we are up against that kind of sociopathy, you know, the sociopaths mm-hmm. that we're up against. And we need that kind of serious political movement. So the book that came out this year that I wrote with Derek Jensen and Eric McBay is called Deep Green Resistance. And it's about how to think politically, why we need a political movement, and then some ideas about the kind of movement that we think might be successful to save our planet. And if you're interested at all in learning more about that, there is a growing movement called Deep Green Resistance based on some of the ideas in the book. We have a website you can go to, deepgreenresistance.org. You can join, you can read all about it, you can read excerpts from the book, you can find out what other people are doing, and we're going to be waging a really big campaign this summer to try to do direct action against some of the oil infrastructure in the United States. Mm-hmm. We're really looking forward to that. It's going to be very serious, but it's also going to be really great. So come and find out about us and see if it's something you want to get involved in. But, you know, whatever it is that your heart loves, I hope that you will remember that you can fight for it.
You've been listening to The Circle Day on Resonance 104.4 FM. You can also catch the show on Catalyst Radio online. Don't forget to go to www.thecircleday.com. to catch past shows, and also like the Facebook page so you are kept up to date. Until next week, turn on, tune in, and kick off.